Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is a true scion of New York. She is incredible energy. She brings passion. She is in the midst of an amazing, very varied career. She's an entrepreneur. She's a performer, a composer. She's had a huge hit all the way up at the top of the Billboard charts. And she's very unique. And Consuelo, there is really only one of you. And you are so completely unique. It was a great joy of mine to get to co-chair the Hispanic Star Annual Gala a few months ago in December. We were two of the co-chairs together. Consuelo Vanderbilt is a seventh generation descendant of shipping and railroad tycoon Cornelius Vanderbilt, whose statue, as I recall, sits outside of Grand Central Terminal at that underpass that sort of cuts through Grand Central. She's lived all over the world. She's an entrepreneur and was at the Guggenheim. We're going to talk about what you have upcoming at the Met, but it's just a joy to talk to you. I don't know how we're going to fit this. We may have to do three or four episodes, Consuelo. A hearty welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. What a beautiful introduction. And I'm blushing over here, even though no one could see me because we're, you know, on a podcast, but you would see I'm rosy. You and I are kind of the same color right now.
There's no audio equivalent of the blush. That is true. So I'd love to go back to early days in Italy. And you studied with some great teachers, Ron Anderson, Seth Riggs, and end up in Italy, performing in cafes and restaurants in and around one of the most magnificent cities, Florence, at a very young age. I know you signed your first record deal at 21, but can we go back to those early days in Florence and remembrances of that era when you were, I guess, late teens or just barely sniffing 20?
Yeah, I was 17 when I moved to Florence. Probably, I would say, one of the greatest times of my life. For everyone that has had the gift of being able to go to Florence, I think just to experience that as a student and just the culture and the Italian people, it was absolutely amazing. And some of my best friends on the planet, I actually met there. Originally, I was living in LA. I graduated high school. I started with Ron Anderson and Seth Riggs, both actually when I was 15 and a half, 16. I was modeling in LA. It's 15, 16. One of my best friends from London came to LA, and you know, my mother had kind of, let's say, passage. She had lived in Italy. My aunt lived in Italy. So it was really, as I said, kind of rite of passage that a lot of the female women in my family spent a lot of time there. Anyway, my best friend from London came over, and she was like, "I don't know what you're doing. What are you doing with your life? You need to move to Italy." "What? What did you?" She's like, no, you really did. This is it. You have to stop what you're doing right now. And you really, this is like that intersection in life is really important. You need to move to Italy right now." So I listened to her and I went and I spoke to my father and I said, "Listen, I think this is the time. I think we need to stop the model and we need to stop what I'm doing. And I need to move to Italy." And for some reason, my parents agreed and they thought, "Yes, okay, this is a really good intersection. We think this is a good plan for you." So I moved to Florence and I was living with an Italian family and one of the greatest women and phenomenal cook, but she would feed me, of course, these wonderful Italian meals like two or three times a day. And I wouldn't eat enough. She's like, "Mangia, mangia." I'm like, "Oh my God, like I'm being buttered up here. Like this is not going to be good." And so I originally started off by going to the British Institute, which is this fantastic school. And I was learning Italian and history of art. I'm not sure how much Italian I actually really adopted, let's say that, and having the best time in Florence. And I then ended up being introduced to this wonderful rock opera school. And it's just with their education, I can't even begin to tell you about like what that looked like as a singer, to scream and to yell in Italian and passion and all of it. And it was just the time of my life. And I started to perform in bars around the Duomo. Again, I'm about 17. And mostly this guitar player who I was performing with, really, you know, He spoke very broken English, which is brilliant, but he was a wonderful guitarist. And so we had this, our own little interpretation, basically, of this kind of mashup of Italian and English. And it was just this fusion of, you know, the beginning stages of me learning about what I loved about music, what I wanted to be singing, how I wanted to be singing, performing, and having wonderful memories in Italy. That was the beginning.
And, you know, very heavy crown to be born into a family with the last name Vanderbilt. How much of what you were doing, and then you went on, you know, basically were on tour all over Europe and had a lot of success. How much of that was pursuing passion? How much of it was being a young rebel? You are very much your own person.
Yes. I would say this, at 21, actually a little bit younger, probably 19 turning 20, my father came to me and he said, listen, if you want to be an artist, that is your choice. The rite of passage, again, kind of what my mother did, what my grandmother did, what my great aunt did, was a very different lifestyle, becoming debutantes. And that was a very specific path, I would say. And my father gave me a choice, and my mom as well, about if I wanted to pursue the life of an artist, then I would need to get a job and live like one. And that was going to be really kind of the breaking point for my parents and for me to be independent, figuring things out on my own. And it was a complicated choice because, as you can imagine, I lived in a wonderful world between how I was raised with my mother and my stepfather and, you know, going and visiting my father, to the way that my grandmother and kind of the tradition of the Vanderbilt women, per se, I would say. So I was able to really have a very, I would say, clear knowledge of what it meant. My stepfather was and is a self-made man and did incredibly well, to the life and path of, you know, kind of the Vanderbilt tradition, I would say. To look myself in the eyes and to say, what kind of road and what kind of world and what kind of person do I want to be? And I made the choice to be an artist. And I have had multiple jobs. I have done things that, you know, I'd say that most people don't even know about, that I really don't normally talk about. But I'm proud of that because I don't think I would ever have learned and to kind of be the person that I am now or to be the artist that I was. So also similarly, it was very important to me that I never used the Vanderbilt name, that I was very clear about that because I really wanted to be known as an artist for my music and for that alone. So when you ask me, and so there's a long-winded answer to the question of like why and what it meant, the pressures of being a Vanderbilt, I think that, you know, I'm so proud, and especially as an adult, really to learn about the extraordinary women of my family that I don't think have been celebrated. And it is my absolute kind of like passion to be able to share and showcase that. But also what Cornelius established and built, and, you know, he was such an exceptional pioneer at, you know, like having the vision to build the entire transportation industry really at the time. And so I am very proud, but I'm also very proud of the choices that I made myself to be independent and to learn what that actually meant and to build credibility on my own.
So you've sort of swung around back towards an embrace of the Vanderbilt history, but that period as a young gal, you got a chance to see the world. You had a hit, you were a really big dance artist and got to go all over Europe, got to go to Australia. I would think that experience as a young artist, you know, really out there, not, I mean, you're not selling out big stadiums and arenas, but you had some pretty good success, Consuela.
Thank you for saying, you know, my first record when I was signed to Sanctuary Records, Dido had just come out, and I loved trip hop and Massive Attack and Portishead and these beautiful, you know, artists in the UK. And I worked with some of the most amazing songwriters on this planet, from Guy Pratt, Magnus Fiennes, I mean, just Nicholas Whitecroft, who was one of my first writers, Matt Prime, who was my soul to the rest of my life. We had, you know, when you find that synergy with certain writers, it's just, it's truly one word, magic. So working in working in London was such an exceptional experience. And then I, when I moved to LA, I had a 7-piece male rock band. And we toured all over, really all over LA. We wrote a song for the American Cancer Society. It was actually about my mom. We donated that 100% of the proceeds to cancer research. And from there, which is what the beauty of music, this amazing DJ that my hairdresser, this is how organic this whole situation happened, said, oh my God, you've got to hear the song Naked. And sure enough, that single stayed on the Billboard charts for the next 16 weeks and went to top 15 at the time. And that was the beginning. And then I had 5 subsequent, my last single was actually number 5 in the US. And it did, it took me into the dance world. And so I toured both, as you said, both in the US and in Europe. And who knew from having, you know, again, this 7-piece male rock band to becoming a dance artist was even possible. So I toured as a dance artist for probably 6 to 7 years. And it was the time of my life. And I put music on hold 4.5 years ago.
When you tour like that, as you did, and it's a great, great story, things often go right. But once in a while, something goes wrong. Was there a particularly funny or memorable incident back in those touring years where something was just, oh boy, that's not what we thought was going to happen?
Oh, yes. Many, many stories, many a time. And actually, one of the, when you just said that, where I had my 2 dancers and we were going to the south of France. And we were told that the setup, and again, the way that the entire, like how the things had been choreographed, stage dependent. I mean, there was a lot of factors here. And when we arrived, I don't think that you could possibly have fit 3 of us on stage at all. So my choreographer got very upset and was like, I will not perform. Like, listen, we're contractually bound right now. I understand the circumstances have changed. This is not a good setup, but we're going to have to figure this out. And he was really not happy. And we ended up doing this actually on the ground, which is impossible because you have, you know, a packed house and you can't hear anything in monitors. And I mean, that was mayhem, but we ended up working it out and he was fantastic. And as he always does, he managed to, you know, reorganize, create something that he did, which, you know, he would make things that were the impossible he made happen. But my goodness, walking into that, I was like, I don't know how on earth this is going to happen. And I've lost my voice on tour. I mean, you know, it's true. It's so unpredictable. You don't know. And that's actually the power of being a vocalist. Sometimes you can't control certain things that do happen.
Right, right. Great, great, great stuff, Consuelo. So you pursue your passion as an artist. You have success. You tour the world. You're on the charts. But somewhere deep inside is that entrepreneurial spirit. You know, our DNA is our DNA. I'd love to talk about the emergence of that spirit. You are really, I think it's fair to call you a serial entrepreneur. You're someone who's inventing, reinventing, you're making stuff happen at a pretty high level and covering an awful lot of ground. I love the Soho Muse story in particular, which we'll get to. But talk about the heightening, if you will, or I won't call it emergence, but really that entrepreneurial flame really started to flower. I don't know that a flame flowers, but you know what I'm trying to say.
But no, I like the analogy. I do think inherently, you know, and again, having 2 very powerful fathers were a wonderful influence as well. But obviously the bloodline of what Cornelius was in the time, you know, one of my favorite quotes is he said, you know, if I had studied or gone to school, I would have had no time for anything else. That's kind of exactly what, you know, my philosophy I'm feeling is the same way, because I've learned everything through experience of people and traveling and being with the world. And that sensibility has really given me my core. I believe education is incredibly important, but this was my journey. So where I really started to see different opportunities or things, you know, it started me creating my first label, CNR Productions. And my manager at the time was really, it was important for us to kind of figure out what distribution deals and territory deals would look like so that you yourself as an artist are far more in control of royalties and transparency and everything else that, you know, sadly a lot of artists we go through and you don't necessarily know the business side to it. So that was really the kind of the beginning of it. And, you know, again, four of my singles were on my label, which is amazing. So then from there, when I moved to New York, and I would say, I submerged myself into the family history because it was just so alive and so there and so prevalent in every way, right? So that being able to, as I kind of started this, celebrate the women of my family, I was given an exceptional opportunity to then build a jewelry line in, and we say homage to the amazing five generations of the women in my family. So from the Gertrude Vanderbilt, who started the Whitney Museum, to my great-great-aunt, Consuela Vanderbilt, you know, who was probably the most prominent of all the women in the family, you know, the suffragette movement and what her mother did. And it just, you know, it was fascinating to me at that point to be able to then look at history, history in the making, kind of what they were, what they represented, and then the jewelry pieces that I myself had inherited and other items that actually I could bring to the forefront and actually be able to tell their stories and kind of relive history in a way, and then making these affordable pieces so you could travel through time and feel like a princess for a day. Kind of that was the analogy. So I would say when we talk about the entrepreneurial spirit and being able, and I love history, how I was able to really bring those two factors to life. I loved being on HSN. Probably one of the greatest experiences of my life because there is no training. I performed in front of five people to 250,000 people. There is no amount of training to go on to HSN and to really understand how to be like a puppeteer in a way because you have your in-ear monitors, you have the producer telling you one thing, then you're dealing with sales and like just a thousand things. So that was kind of the beginning of really me figuring out again these kind of entrepreneurial initiatives, I would say.
I love it. It's just a fantastic story. One of the things that happens along your journey of invention, reinvention, is you become a public figure. And you appear in the paper, Page Six becomes part of your world in some fashion. Talk about balancing that, and is it something that is you view as an additive part of the mix of your life, or is it sort of an annoyance in the mix of your life?
Press is one of those things. Press can create so many additional opportunities for you, awareness for you, awareness also for great causes, awareness to help. You know, I've always wanted to be a person organically that helps what we kind of say the underdog people who don't necessarily have a voice, opportunities that I feel like I've been able to do that. So where press comes in and again kind of can help to position one to give them that platform. But in the same breath, press can also be negative and can do the complete opposite. In my world, I was always so grateful because my press was always really aligned to my business, never was personal. And only up until recently, really did it become more personal. And so, as I said, it's been a wonderful gift and to be able to work with journalists who supporting my initiatives and that I've really been able to do great things with it. And then there's been, you know, some things that have also happened that that I wish didn't come. So, you know, it's I think it's played both sides. And Page Six has actually been very kind to me, so I'm grateful for that.
Right. Yeah, it I guess it's a quintessential mixed bag, and so much of the press today, you know, what comes to mind is I had a very old and dear friend. He's no longer with us. His name is Bud Greenspan. Bud was a legendary filmmaker and really invented the genre of the sports documentary. Bud had an interesting distinction. He had the most frequent flyer miles of anyone in the world. He was at every Olympics, 1948. His last was 2010 in Vancouver. And he did every official film for the IOC for the Olympic Games. They were called 16 Days of Glory. And Bud would take 4, 5, 6 athletes from each games and do a vignette, 15, 20 minute story. And often it would not necessarily be the most famous, but someone who had entered the arena to compete. So in 84, it wasn't necessarily Jackie Joyner and Carl Lewis, you know, it was other athletes. He did a very famous one on a British athlete and who pulled up with a lame hamstring and couldn't finish the race. Derek Redmond, and famously dragged his leg around the track knowing he couldn't finish. But Bud would often be criticized because he had a very positive view. And he would say the media spends 90% of their time on the 10% that's negative. I spend 100% of my time on the 90% that's positive. And I think today, more so than in recent history, simply because it's what sells newspapers, so to speak, the press really loves to go hard and negative and tear people apart. And when you're on the receiving end of that, that's got to not feel so great.
But when it comes into, you know, and I love what you just shared about that, you know, I think when it becomes your personal life, right? And it's like with anything, you know, you become vulnerable, you know, and people who are not necessarily in the media have then immediate perceptions of what you are, what is, what's the truth, what's fact, right? So then you're spending a lot of the time having to negate that. And then everything that you were trying to actually do and do good can be actually taken away. And that's the sadness of it, to be honest. You know, like, I think, if you know, it's often things are just misinterpreted. So I wish that there was another voice like yours here to be able to actually clarify and speak the truth of what one's intentions were, or, you know what I mean? So, and also the other thing about the internet, as we know, and especially of today, you know, reputation is so unbelievably fragile. So the second that it's tainted or tarnished in some way, it's really hard to remedy that. And that's really sad, you know? So you could have spent a lifetime building something and then it's taken away so easily. That's the other terrifying thing about press and media and how careful you have to be.
Yeah, no, it's a quintessential double-edged sword. So, all right, let's move to Soho Muse, because that's how we met. It's give or take, I guess, now almost 6, 7 years old. The platform launched to create and really fill a gap, to create a network for creative professionals, to network, to collaborate across a wide menu of creative industries. But let's go back to sort of the inception and give us the Soho Muse origin story, because I don't think I know the whole story.
So I would come home from the studio late at night and I was looking for a world of inspiration. And I was like, what would a world be if a painter, an actor, a writer, a director could all connect, create, and collaborate in one space in real time? And that was the beginning concept, really, about really finding your inspiration, finding your thread, right? What that looked like. And then my business partner, Umi McGuckin, had really specialized both in advertising and had a profound knowledge of technology. The two of us came together to really kind of blossom this idea and put it into the world. And what we built, and that's a prototype built, were these 3D worlds where, you know, pre to everything, the metaverse and things like that, pre to Zoom, it was Skype. It was very advanced on that entire premise of inspiration and creativity and visual stimulation, right? So around the time of MySpace, if you remember that. And then as I really grew as an artist and were building an auteur, I started to see, and you will understand this in our world, that the freelance economy, so whether that's the below the line talents of the makeup artists, the hairstylists of the world, to above the line talents, right? The dancers, the singers. What happens, as an example, you're on tour and you lose a dancer? What happens when you lose a makeup artist? What happens? Management needs to then go to multiple different agencies to find that specific talent. So I'm like, well, isn't there a silo of, let's say, a unified place where you can find all of that talent? And it's not. It's incredibly fragmented. And we look at creatives that are very, very multifaceted. If I'm a singer, I'm probably a songwriter. I'm probably a producer, a dancer. So now what does my world look like? Do I have 4 to 5 different reps for all of those people? Unless you're of the top 10% signed to the William Morris CAs of the world, they are, you know, only packaging the 10%. So what happens to the rest of the 90%? Now we have a $2 trillion industry growing exponentially. Like what is that? What does it all look like? And then looking at LinkedIn, which is such a powerful networking tool, but such a business sense, I was like, well, can't all these worlds combine into kind of creating one silo, one 360 environment where creatives can find each other, create with each other, job opportunities? And couldn't that be a vetted world so that in any given city, you and your wonderful, like, understanding the world of advertising so well as you do, Brand X is looking to put a campaign together that there is one nucleus vetted place to be able to find all of that. And that really became, I would say, the birth of 2019, the launch of Soho Muse was all about that.
And you're a number of years in now. It's a fantastic idea. How's it going?
So, you know, through COVID, I didn't know what was going to happen. I don't think any of us did, you know, just kind of figuring out what the world was going to really unfold. What I found from there is we were able to become like one of the first platforms that were showcasing, you know, like amazing artists around the world and having them perform and building that out and building audiences from there and building voice panel series for BLM and like giving voice to our creative market. And in that, I was really able to diversify and build out our talent and our talent pool. So that actually worked in our favor. So I would say where we are today is that I have, it's a multiple tier site. Our younger tier, which is for high school students, college students, really we're trying to build the platform to help to inspire them for mentorship opportunities. Mentorship opportunities, internship and job opportunities, because looking at universities of today, and I keep hearing this from students, they go and they're looking for career guidance and they get given a website portal, but they don't necessarily have the relationships. It's like, we want to be that facilitator. And then for our main tier, giving them, you know, amazing job opportunities all across the board, because my entire thesis and theme of this site is to make sure the creatives get paid. It's not okay.
Absolutely fantastic. And it's a really clever evolution of your experience. You know, we started back in Florence, and I am certain, consciously and subconsciously, there are lots of bits and pieces of the construct of Soho Muse that really are grounded in your own experience as an artist. And it's a wonderful story. And we have to do something together at Advertising Week in the fall with Soho Muse. I'm throwing down the gauntlet.
The gauntlet. Yes.
Throwing it down
it's
right
happening.
Now.
We're doing it. Yes.
All right. So let's talk about Latin Ignition, which is another great project. I know it's about to have another chapter. Something that you started with Emilio Estefan, who we had on stage with Gloria many years ago. It was a great double bill. We had a little Broadway block, and we had a conversation with Lin-Manuel Miranda just as Hamilton was breaking. And then we had Gloria and Emilio. They had a Broadway show. It didn't really work. It was short-lived. And then we had Jimmy Buffett before he passed. He had a show on Broadway also that didn't really work, but we loved having them all. Let's talk about something that is working, Latin Ignition, and tell us about the next chapter, which is really exciting.
I'm so happy that, you know, you've met them and spent time with them, because they're two just magnificent human beings, and the success that the both of them have had is just extraordinary. And he's a wonderful mentor to me. So understanding that 18% of the US market is derived of the Latin market, which most people don't have any idea the magnitude actually of the size of the space. And just, you know, where I really started to see culturally is how much talent there is, but how insanely fragmented it also is as well. And how does that talent reach, and Claudia, you know, this is where we really resonated, how do you find those specific Latin artists, and how did they find job opportunities, and how did the two worlds integrate, and how all of this, and as I said, you know, my whole thing is about really helping for the people that don't necessarily have a voice to create opportunities. So when I sat down with Emilio, we originally, you know, were looking at a specific TV show that was coming out of this, which, you know, I really hope we come back to revisit that. And one of the things was really being able to highlight this exceptional talent, both in fashion and music, and giving them and elevating their platform to giving them an opportunity to showcase themselves in an amazing way. And that's really what the Guggenheim was. So this event that happened, New York Fashion Week, we were able to take four extraordinary designers, all the makeup artists, all the models, every single person that participated in that event were derived in some way, in some capacity, that word from the Latin community. And to be able to really elevate them in that way and to give them their voice. I feel that there's been so much attention in other demographics and not necessarily in theirs. And that was really important. And it was, and I'm so incredibly proud. It really took over from every single media channel on this planet. It became that voice, and everyone was paid. And that was another side of it, because oftentimes, you know, you don't, and people are doing favors, and the, you know, it's not, no, every single talent that participated there was paid. So we're coming back this September 7th. We have a holding date now at the Met, which is amazing. So taking from the Guggenheim to the Met, and considering the Met Gala, I mean, why shouldn't there be the Latin ignition at the Met?
Great story. And I think, you know, you referenced the size and scope, and Claudia talks about the spending power of the Hispanic market, but it is fragmented. And I think that's where people like yourself, people like our mutual friend, Claudia Romo, who brought us together, and Hispanic Star, to serve as an advocate for what is the fastest growing part of America. And really looking to the future, you know, arguably, I don't want to say most important part, but certainly fastest growing is very meaningful. And that well within our lifetimes, America will be more than 50% non-white, with Hispanics comprising the largest piece of that. That suggests that those flowers are worth paying attention to and watering.
I love that.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. And you have some other entrepreneurial ventures as we start to wrap. What else can we look forward to for the rest of 24 and 25, Consuelo?
So 24, I'm launching a purse line, which is very exciting, with this brilliant Latin designer named Jimena Cavaler Cas. I'm learning Spanish. And she's extraordinary, from Sarah Jessica Parker to the royal family, people that have worn her beautiful purses. And so we're launching that, which is very exciting. A book in the progress, which is amazing, and very excited about that. That's a long time coming.
Fantastic. Well, this was such a joy. I can't thank you enough for doing this. We covered an awful lot of ground, and I think that's really who you are. You cover a lot of ground. Let's figure out something for Soho Muse for the fall. An absolute joy to have you on Great Minds. So thank you so much for doing this.
I'm so grateful. And the last thing that I just want to say is we are doing actually a career day, starting with the University of Miami. Part of our platform is this ed tech side. And when I was discussing the mentorship and giving opportunities, I would say both to the younger students, but also to our talent to be able to teach and give back. Similarly, like different from a Maven or a Teachable, where they're having to outsource talent, we have everything in-house. We are doing a career day to really help young students who don't necessarily know about specific areas in the creative industry, let's say set design or sound design, giving them and showcasing this, and then bringing in a financial institution. So it's understanding what, how to build your business and how to be a creative, and the two merge together, and bringing then an A-list talent as a mentor. So it's really part of our kind of, like, say, setting new paradigms and new precedences, which is precedent. Parents understanding actually that this, the creative world, is a huge market, that we shouldn't be telling our kids that this isn't a good idea to be going down and venturing here, that there is a lot of money to be made. They just may not know about these other areas in the creative world that they can actually make money. So
Great stuff. And as a seventh generation member of the Vanderbilt family, I got to think somewhere Cornelius is up there smiling at you spending so much time developing that next generation of talent, that next generation of railway builders in the modern world. I guess today would be a digital railway, but I absolutely love that.
I love you for saying that because that's exactly what Soho Muse is. That's the digital railway. I love you that you said that. That is what I am trying to build. So thank you. That's a wonderful analogy. Thank you.
Fantastic. All right. We'll see you soon.
Thank you. Bye now.